This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 240 was recorded on October 8th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. With the presidential election now less than a month away, it's time to bring back former U.S. presidential advisor and best-selling author Dr. Pippa Malmgren as this week's feature interview guest. Pippa and I will discuss everything from the outlook for markets and various election scenarios to the risk of an increase in civil unrest after the election to Pippa's prediction that President Trump will aspire to create his own television news empire after leaving the White House, regardless of whether that happens in 2021 or after four more years as president. Patrick Ceresna is off this week, so Kevin Muir, author of the popular Macro Tourist blog, joins me as this week's co-host. So be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Kevin and I will discuss the U.S. dollar, inflation, and why Kevin thinks a curve steepener trade is the best way to play these macro trends.
And I'm Kevin Muir, filling in for Patrick Ceresna. Eric, we certainly got a little excitement with Trump's Tuesday afternoon tweet that he was instructing his representatives to stop negotiating on the fiscal deal due to the fact that he thought Pelosi was acting in not good faith, which caused the stock market to sell off. But now we're right back to the highs of the week. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that's a microcosm of a bigger picture. You're talking about just today's action, but look back at the last couple of weeks. The president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, gets a disease which, in his age demographic, has a fairly high fatality rate, and the stock market sells off for less than three market days before hitting a very buyable dip moment. And as you say, even in the face of a lot of news and you know, news flow action today, which should have been negative, it seems like nothing sticks to this market. It all bounces back off. So it's clear to me that market sentiment is, you know, the Fed's got our back no matter what, nothing can go wrong. And of course, those assumptions tend to last until something does go wrong. The election is still the dominant factor. So was this little blip we had over the COVID scare when the president got the coronavirus disease just a little pause in the market, and we're moving higher after a contested election is sorted out? You know, I kind of think about Jeff Snyder's comment about when I said he was bullish the dollar, and he says, no, don't call me bullish. I think it's going up, but not for good reasons. I feel like this market just really wants to move higher. And I think once the election is resolved, clearly, so we know who's president, it probably is moving higher. Does that mean I'm bullish, like I believe in the economy and the fundamentals? No, but it seems like the market just wants to go higher and is looking for an excuse, even if I don't think that that makes sense. The thing is, we don't know that we're going to get a clear election outcome. So I'm really looking forward to asking Pippa Malmgren in this week's feature interview what it's going to mean if we don't know at first who the new president of the United States really is.
Eric, during the risk-off move that Tuesday afternoon, we saw the U.S. dollar get a little bit of a bid, but it seems to have stalled. What's your outlook there?
Well, what I can say confidently in my confident announcer voice, Kevin, is that the single most important issue in macroeconomics is the U.S. dollar, and those who have it figured out have a serious edge over the lesser, intellectually weaker market participants who don't have it figured out. The next thing I can say is I'm one of those guys who doesn't have it figured out yet. I don't think there's a clear technical signal here yet. You have to rely on fundamentals, and those fundamentals are a really complex picture. There's a lot of reasons you should expect flight to safety trades to take the dollar much higher here. Frankly, you know, when you got the president of the United States infected with a disease which is often deadly in people in his age demographic, although he, if he's faking the recovery, he's certainly doing a very good job of faking the recovery. It seems like he's off the hook already. And we don't know where this election is headed. So it's a really complex picture. I don't know what the answer is. Jury's still out of my mind. As far as I'm concerned, you'd need a daily close above 95 or below 92 to get a really solid technical indication as to where the market's headed. And we don't have that yet. Let's revisit this, though, in more detail, Kevin, because I know you've been writing about this in the Macro Tourist blog. And I want to go into more detail than we have time for in the market wrap after the feature interview with Pippa Malmgren.
Sounds great, Eric. I'm looking forward to that. In the meantime, why don't we move on to what I always tune into Macro Voices with the most excitement each week, which is your views on crude oil. Where do you see this market headed?
Not only are we rallying on the front month today, now the front month flat price is not quite back to that 41.72 level, which was the previous cycle high set back in the middle of September. But here's what I think is actually more important. The back of the curve time spreads are already breaking out to new levels, considerably higher than their previous highs, and also outside, they've broken through trend lines that existed on the charts during the previous cycle. So we're seeing the breakout occur not first on the flat price, but on the back of curve time spreads. Longtime listeners know that I have been long the Z1, Z2 spread. That's long the December of 2021, short the December of 2022 crude oil futures contract in size, because I think that's the best way to play an expectation of a return to backwardation in 2021. I've been talking about that on Macro Voices for 6 months. I see now that some of the biggest names in the crude oil financial media are starting to tweet about that Z1, Z2 spread and what's going on there. So we're seeing a breakout, which hasn't been confirmed yet in the flat price, but it's definitely there in the back of the curve, and I tend to put more credence in that. Now, there is a caveat, which is, why is crude oil in general breaking out? Well, we've got a number of factors, some of which might be temporary. One of them is, of course, the storm in the Gulf of Mexico, a hurricane about to hit the Gulf Coast. And of course, that means they have to shut in production in the Gulf. That tends to drive the price up, but only in the short term. We've also got OPEC jawboning the market. Today, they said the worst is over for the oil market and OPEC sees higher prices ahead. Well, why are they saying that on this particular day? Pardon my cynicism, Kevin, but I think the reason is because these OPEC guys are pretty darn smart, and they know that we're approaching a very key technical level at 41.72, and if they can jawbone the market to get a daily close above that price, it's probably going to have legs and will move much higher. So OPEC, I think, is very clearly trying to manipulate this market higher. And frankly, you know, that doesn't mean it's not going to last. They're often successful when they do that. So we do need, because these things are to some extent based on circumstance and propaganda, I think we need a few days of this trend to continue before it's really confirmed. But it looks to me like we could be on the cusp of an upside breakout, and of course a breakout above the previous high on the flat price. The previous high again was 41.72 on the front month WTI contract. We need to see a higher price, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, just after the pit close. We're looking at 41.18. So we're still half a dollar below the level that we need to be in order to really cement this. But it looks to me like something is afoot toward a move higher. Moving on to inventory this week, crude oil building, a surprise build of 500,000 barrels nationally. But that is also offset by a drawdown of 1.1 million barrels in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So the net is still a drawdown of 0.6 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 470,000 barrels. The drawdowns were on finished products. Gasoline drawing down 1.4 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 962,000 barrels. U.S. production ticking up substantially, 300,000 barrels this week to 11 million barrels. So we're not seeing the decline in U.S. production that Art Berman has spoken about. But as we had Art back on the program last week, he said, hey, that might not come until the end of Q4. Just because he said Q4 doesn't mean now we're in Q4, it's going to happen. Could be Christmas before that happens. That's going to be the thing to watch. And I think that when we see confirmation in terms of the actual EIA report, let's say not because of a tropical storm shutting in production, but just because of natural forces in the market, when we see that U.S. production number drop below 10 and particularly below 9.5 million barrels, I think that's where you're really going to see some acceleration of price to the upside and a return to backwardation in the term structure of the crude oil market. And again, that Z1, Z2 spread is my favorite way to play that.
That's some great stuff, Eric. For the technical people, they'll be watching those levels. And for the fundamentally inclined, you've given them some great things to watch for. Let's move on to gold. It doesn't seem to be getting anywhere near the traction that many of the gold bulls were hoping. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I'm a gold bull, and I'm hoping for downside so I can buy some more at a cheaper price. You know, we do have some reasons to expect a further consolidation and maybe a further correction to the downside. Now, we're still holding above the 100-day moving average. Remember what I said last week was, okay, the gold price was selling off pretty sharply, hit the 100-day moving average and bounced. And I said, okay, is it just a bounce, dead cat bounce, or is that really a reversal of trend? So far, it's looking more like it was just a bounce because it came off the 100-day, went up and perfectly tested twice, actually, two daily candles, perfectly testing the 21-day moving average. But we're still holding above the 100-day, right about on the 13-day moving average as we record on Thursday afternoon at $1,897, just below $1,900. So there's definitely, I think, a case to be made that maybe the 100-day moving average is going to hold it. I hope it doesn't, because if it breaks, there's more support right around 1,800, but then it's not till you get about 1,758 is the 200-day moving average. And I think we have a real chance of getting there, particularly if there was a clean sweep in the election. So a lot of people are fearing that there's going to be a contested election. Nobody's sure who's president. The Supreme Court gets involved. If those things don't happen, I think gold is going to sell off and it's going to create a buying opportunity. And I think under those circumstances, we would very likely get to 1758, or at least to the 200-day moving average, which by then will probably be above 1758. The problem is, I don't think it's terribly likely that we're not going to have a contested election. I think we will have a contested election, and that might be the impetus for gold to move higher. If so, the number to watch on the upside is around 1937. A close above that level would represent an upside breakout in the descending triangle pattern that's been in play really since the beginning of August, and that would suggest that a bullish breakout is occurring.
And finally, Eric, 10-year Treasury yields. They've been sleepy forever, but there seemed to be some excitement this week. Do you think this is the start of a bigger move lower?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a big move lower. I don't really have a short-term opinion. As we look out longer term, I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that inflation is coming. I just don't know how soon. And I want to revisit this topic in the post-game segment after the feature interview, because I know you've been writing about it. It seems clear to me that the bond bull market ends and bond yields go up once it's confirmed that inflation is not just a twinkle in a few people's eyes, but it really is happening and nobody questions whether it's happening. We're not quite there yet. So is it just a few months off or is it a few years off? I'm leaning more and more toward a few months as opposed to a few years. I think maybe that low yield, whatever it was on an intraday basis on the 10-year, 35 basis points or something, maybe that really was the end of the 38-year bond bull market. Let's come back to that in the post-game segment.
This week's featured interview guest is former U.S. presidential advisor, Dr. Pippa Mahlgren. Eric, why did we invite Pippa back to the show this week?
Well, needless to say, it's less than a month until the election. Pippa used to actually work in the White House advising the U.S. president. You know, this is the time to get Pippa on the show, to get her perspective, not only on what's going on, but what this will mean for markets. And I think you'll be surprised at some of the market prognostications that she has. They're not consensus views. So I'm really looking forward to this interview. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a five-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step-by-step, are in your Research Roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk-on to risk-off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Pippa Mulgrum is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is former U.S. presidential advisor and best-selling author, Dr. Pippa Mulgrum. Pippa, holy cow, where to start with this interview? I don't think there's ever been a better month for a Dr. Pippa Mulgrum interview. You used to work in the White House advising the President of the United States. You worked as a part of a team which, among other things, advised the U.S. President on how to appear presidential in the public eye. Well, why don't we start with the recent debate? How would you say that both candidates did in terms of upholding that presidential image?
Well, I thought it was just fascinating that the single most Googled phrase during and right after the debate was how to move to Canada, which kind of tells you everything. It's really interesting watching this because in a way, the public wanted reality TV to come into politics, and now it really has. And it's just emotional with no substance. It's just interruption with no points being made. It's kind of, everybody's in search of an argument. And while sort of fascinating at one level, it's not fascinating enough. And it was really interesting to see how few people watched it and how many people tuned out once they had started. So neither one of these men came off being inspirational or inspirational leaders in any way.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court and what's going on there. I guess there's a pretty big divide between some people are saying that the president's job is to immediately propose a replacement for a deceased justice. Others are arguing that, no, it's really the end of his term. We should wait and see who the next president is and let them decide who's on the Supreme Court. What is the real legal precedent? Who's supposed to decide this?
Well, you know, this is not just true for the Supreme Court. This is true for all presidential appointments. And every presidency I've ever observed has always moved to put their own appointee in as soon as possible and to deny that place on the chessboard to the opposing team. You don't see that graciousness that says, oh, well, you guys are going to be in charge next. Why don't we hold it open for you. I've never seen that happen with any kind of presidential appointment. But the Supreme Court obviously has more visibility and more scrutiny because of its extraordinary importance in American society. And we're at this moment in history where the court is turning in a particular direction that many want to see and many others definitely don't want to see. And so it's more contentious than usual. And of course, now it's even more complicated because we've got a couple of the members of the actual Judiciary Committee themselves are now down with COVID. And so will they even be able to come in to vote is an open question. And it's such a tight margin. It's like a really open question. So again, you know, everybody's on tenterhooks, like one little thing could change the outcome so dramatically here.
The thing that was most striking to me about the debate was the last question where the moderator asked both candidates, are you willing to firmly tell your supporters right here and now, don't turn to violence if I don't win? And neither one of them was willing to do that. And meanwhile, we have other politicians who have actually gone so far as to use words like, we need you to be ready to fight. If ever there were fighting words, be ready to fight is them. Are we headed toward a situation, Pippa, where, I mean, it seems like an almost certainty that there has to be some kind of contested election. Are we going to get to a situation where obviously there has to be some civil unrest, but is it going to reach the point where the candidates are actually encouraging that from their supporters as opposed to what I would consider to be the more responsible thing of telling them that violence is never the solution to any kind of dispute like that?
So, you know, here's the thing. Let's back up a little bit before we even get to these questions and understand what's happening. What's happening is COVID, it's a very interesting disease in that it reveals the underlying and pre-existing conditions initially in a human, but then it also reveals it in companies, in economies, and now in societies. Now, one of the previously existing conditions in American society was that the African-American community had not achieved a place in that society commensurate with their rights, with their size, with the hard work that they've engaged in. The sense of injustice is palpable. And, you know, certain events contributed to that even more. But I think, you know, everybody's had a kind of underlying sense of discomfort. I know that I'd give speeches to big companies in America, you know, huge corporates. And I walk in, and in the last decade, I've seen many more women in every room, but I've still not seen people of color. And I wonder, where is everybody? You know, where are all the people that I went to university with or educated and bright and part of the economy, but they're not in the establishment, at least not to the degree that I think probably makes sense. Anyway, that community of people who are worried about this issue have felt the pressure of COVID, the realization that time has run out. We've had enough time to address it, and so something must be done. That's where your question comes in. What to be done? And, you know, the gracious approach, the Martin Luther King approach, the Mahatma Gandhi approach, the Nelson Mandela approach is the nonviolence and stand for your principles. And there are many people in that camp in the United States today. But in all heated situations, there's also a group of people who aren't so measured, aren't so reflective and thoughtful, aren't so disciplined, maybe bring a different philosophy to the table. And that has ended up in confrontation. Now, I think the confrontations that we're seeing in America are not exclusively about this issue. It's also tied up with the gaps between the rich and the poor. I think there are arguments, too, between the urban and the rural, which is not a color-based. It's not a color-based issue. That's just to do with different geographical priorities. So the bottom line is there is a lot of anger at this time for a whole bunch of reasons. And COVID itself is definitely bringing out, if you had mental issues before, they're more visible now. If you didn't, but you're experiencing stress, Well, COVID is magnifying all of that. So we have people who are not in their usual frame of mind. And I think just taken all together, yes, what you get is civil unrest. And as you know, I started writing about the prospects for the resurgence of civil unrest back in about 2015 with a couple of books that I wrote at that time, trying to explain why. And a lot of it has to do with we have been taking the rules of the game very much for granted, and that they are not fixed. They are fluid. They can change. And right now, all of these pressures from a weak economy, from COVID, from the stress between the left and the right, suddenly the rules are up for grabs. Now, when the rules themselves, right, when you don't know what is the game we're playing, is it football or is it tennis? Or is it neither? It's actually a new kind of civil war. Like, what is it we're dealing with? In that environment, it pays to fight the rules, break the rules, reshape them, reframe them, reform them. And that's what people are doing. And they're doing it with different levels of anger, different levels of energy. So the question is, what are people in leadership positions doing about this? And so one of the things I've written about in my new book, The Infinite Leader, that's only just come out, in fact, this week, is that leadership is not always about that other guy over there. It's about you. And every one of us exercises leadership in a personal capacity every single day. And the decisions that you make about how you're going to behave and what issues you're going to take a stand on definitely have an impact. And I think part of what's happening is because people don't feel confident in our political leaders on either side, they are starting to take power into their own hands and make their own decisions. And by definition, that means we're going to get a whole range of decisions falling out of that. Some people are going to say, that means I pick up a Molotov cocktail and I burn down a building. Some people are going to say, that means I walk with dignity through the street to make my protest clear and known. And we're going to get a huge array of different responses. The question is, can anybody in the top of politics then say anything that causes a particular outcome? And I think right now, the Democrats don't have enough confidence in Joe Biden. The Republicans don't have enough confidence in Donald Trump as a leader, as a uniting force to be affected by anything they say. And in a way, because both of them are being so partisan, none of them are rising above politics to say, let us unite the nation. They're saying, let us divide the nation. Well, it just encourages more of the same. So I think that we're in for a period of social protest. And I don't mean things getting burned down necessarily, but I do mean real social protests where people object. They try to change. They try to create a new rule system. And usually the end of that process is very positive because you end up with a new agreement, a new social contract as to what is the way we're going to go forward. I know it's a painful process to go through, and I'm not advocating violence in any way. But usually when you get to the end of this kind of social stress period, you get stability out of it. So I'm optimistic about where we're going. The way we're getting there isn't very easy.
I want to pick up on a phrase you used just a minute ago, a new kind of civil war. Tell us more about what you mean, because it seems to me we do have scope for this unrest to grow to a scale that really is a civil war. But obviously, this is not the 1800s. We're not going to dig trenches and have soldiers on either side with muskets trying to shoot at each other. It seems like we're already seeing burning things down. Major arsons are one of the elements of these new tactics of what I think could escalate into this new kind of civil war. What are the other attributes? What is this new kind of civil war? What does it look like?
Well, another attribute of it is its digital quality. And there's a lot of writing about, and you and I have talked in the past about the changed balance of power between states and citizens and the use of data and digitization the use of mobile phones, for example, to track behaviors. And again, COVID has totally accelerated that process with the introduction of track and trace and ever larger powers and freedoms by governments to keep an eye on the citizens using their electronic technology. And every nation does this differently. Recently, I think just this week, we saw in Hong Kong, the Chinese authorities blocked off a few city blocks, and everyone inside those few city blocks basically had a data search done. And it heavily targeted young people because they're trying to find who are the protesters, who are the organizers of the protests against the Chinese state. And so basically your digital identity, which is in your phone, gives away so much information about you, who you connect with, where you've physically been. It's capable of being used as a microphone to record everything that you say. There's a record of all your emails, all your communications, all your text messages. So, you know, this is the new war zone is a data space. And I don't think that we've reached an agreement about what's a reasonable amount of data for governments to have access to and what's not. I don't think we've reached that in China, and I don't think we've reached it in the West either, because it's all so new. You know, people still don't even understand that they're giving away that information. They still will, you know, have conversations in front of an Alexa and think that that's still private, when in fact all that data is, you know, easily auctioned off on the net and available for sale. So I think data is the second war space or war zone where the civil unrest is unfolding. And then I think another area of it has to do with morals. And this is such a super controversial area because everyone takes the high ground and says, my morals are better than your morals. But the point is, they're all arguing about what's the right set of morals. And I think that's a really fascinating fight about philosophically, what are the right set of morals for modern society? And that's why, again, the Supreme Court issue is so important. And we just saw this opinion being released by Justice Clarence Thomas that calls into question the case that allowed gay marriages. And, you know, such an interesting question because, you know, for me, when I was growing up, a conservative was liberal in the sense that the view was once you get to your own front door, anything you want to do should be allowed inside, you know, within a certain reason. But, you know, basically the freedom to be who you were was protected. Today, that's not considered the conservative position. And the liberal position has moved to, we're entitled to come into your house and tell you what you can and can't do. It's like a complete reversal of where things used to be. So some of this is navigating in a moral space, which is a bit like the 17th, 18th centuries, particularly 18th century, where those were the kinds of issues that we had civil unrest over. They were moral issues, and we're seeing maybe a repeat of history on that front.
Now, a lot of Americans focus on the domestic aspects of this and the domestic policy aspects of this. I tend to think more about this in a different context, which is I feel that for many years now, China particularly and a number of other nations have been waiting for their moment of opportunity where there's a vulnerability in the strength of the American nation to where they could do something to change the dynamics and particularly to try to displace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. Are we headed toward a situation where an uprising of civil unrest in the wake of a contested election could create a moment of opportunity for China or other nations, either militarily or, I think more likely, financially, to make an attack, so to speak, on the United States?
Well, look, geopolitics is alive and well, and we are definitely seeing the superpowers facing off against each other. And they're doing it in lots of different ways, some of which are visible, some of which not so visible. There's definitely a race for the command of space. meaning outer space. And there's a race for the command of data. And there's a race for resources. So some of the most intriguing geopolitical conflicts now are occurring in really obscure places, like the border between India and China, where there's big argument about water. So I think, you know, this traditional way of thinking that, you know, China wants to displace the US dollar. Yeah, I get it. But it's not necessarily the highest priority. I think a higher priority is how to achieve domestic security. And that's more about resources and relationships. And that's what the Chinese focus on, is deepening their access to resources, energy, food, water, and deepening the relationships that they can rely upon at the expense of the United States. Now, what goes along with that is the building of payment systems, and the Chinese have been very active in talking about their new digital currencies, which they do see as being global in nature. And, you know, is displacing the dollar over time part of that? Sure, definitely. I'm just saying it's not like they wake up every morning going, let's displace the dollar. It's more that they wake up every morning going, let's make sure that we have enough food. And part of that is food security and the ability to pay for it wherever it is in the world. I think Russia's a bit different. And it was the United States that really called into question Russia's ability to manage its affairs in the world economy. Because once we started to say that we would use SWIFT, the payments mechanism, as a geopolitical tool, so if the Russians behave badly, we would deny them access to the SWIFT bank clearing system. So they said, fine, we'll just create our own SWIFT, which they now have. So it wasn't that they woke up saying, let's displace the dollar. It was more that a geopolitical event occurred and they realized their vulnerability to the US dollar and found a way to diminish that vulnerability. And I do think that the commercial warfare between Russia and the United States or the West is definitely intensifying. And we can see that in companies like, you must be familiar with Wirecard and the big fraud that happened at Wirecard. You know, it's a multi-billion dollar fraud. And it turns out that the finance director was not only a Russian, but someone who's taken refuge and is considered an ally of President Putin's. And it's raised lots of questions, like, what was that really about? Was that really just a commercial enterprise that went wrong? Or was that a geopolitical strategy to create a payment system in the West that was fraudulent and use it as a means of extracting information about how business is conducted in the West? Maybe compromising information about people using that payment system. Like what was that objective? Or is it just coincidence that the finance director appears to now be in exile under President Putin's protection? Maybe it is. But it's an open question. We don't know. Is what is this modern geopolitics about, especially in the commercial arena, which is kind of a very different way of thinking about geopolitics than we are used to?
Pippa, how should investors be thinking about this election and particularly the accuracy of the polls? Because according to the polls, it's pretty darn clear that Biden is strongly in the lead. Some people have suggested, however, that really there's a lot of room for things to change, and there's also a lot of room for those polls to be wrong because of biases that are built into them. Is this thing a done deal? Is this election in the bag for Biden at this point, or is that not the case?
So I think the first thing that really matters is the demographics of America are changing so rapidly that I don't think these polls are able to capture what's really happening. So for example, we're seeing an exodus of people from both California and New York into the interior of the United States, particularly into Texas and places like Arizona. So this is really interesting. Arizona starts to look like it's going to be a Biden-supporting state. And traditionally, that's not where Arizona's been. So it's the morphing of the demographics of politics inside America as the coastlines migrate to the interior. and it changes the flavor of politics. And I think you'll see this in Texas as well. Texas is becoming a less wholly conservative state and becoming more liberal and left-leaning, and again, in part because Austin has become, in my opinion, the new Silicon Valley, the epicenter of innovation in technology in the United States. It's an incredible collection of the brightest minds in the country now all ending up there. And that's put a very liberal bent on that community. So naturally, they vote differently than they used to vote in Austin. So I personally think that these old notions about what the people are like in any given state are just outdated. And the polls are not catching this. And I also think that the silent Trump vote is probably bigger now than it was in 2016. People find that quite shocking and surprising. But I think it is. And one of the things I've been watching closely is the African-American vote for Trump, which has been rising and really rising substantially in recent weeks. And everybody goes, well, what? How can that possibly be? So let me put it in stark terms. When people talk about the Black vote in America, they assume it's one unified block. Well, this is crazy. Nobody says the white vote in America is one unified block. It certainly isn't. And the Black vote isn't either. So what we're seeing is a differentiation, and it's the middle class mothers kind of over the age of 40, who it turns out are remarkably pro-law and order. And often in communities where the whole police force is principally African-American. And so they're the opposite of the defund the police crowd. They're the fund the police, because that's my son, that's my daughter, that's my nephew, that's my niece. And those people, their vote for Trump has clearly been going up as a result of the social unrest. And so that's shocking to a lot of people. How can you have anybody who's in that African-American community voting for Trump? And the answer is, well, some people are putting that as a higher priority than you would have guessed. Equally, you know, the Trump supporting, you know, white community is, I think there are a lot of silent Trumpers there as well. And a good deal of distaste for how he conducts himself. But when they look at the policy, they go, but I don't want to bring in Biden because what he represents is a significant move to the left, potentially. And people are nervous about, well, what does that mean in a COVID world where I'm already taking a big hit? The economy is already down. COVID is already a huge challenge. Do I want to add to that more regulation, more red tape, bigger government, more aggressive tax policy? Is that really what I want? So they might hold their nose and say, well, I don't really like Trump, but I really don't know what I'm going to get on the other side. And I'm not too comfortable with that. And I think that there is a lack of clarity. And probably if Biden does win, we're going to find it takes probably at least 2 years, maybe a year, but probably 2 years for the Democrats to sort out exactly what their policy really will be, because they're so divided between a very far left by American standards and a center position, which isn't really strongly supported. So how far to the left are they going to go is a seriously open question. So to that end, I think all these polls are going to miss all the stuff I just walked you through. So I think it's wide open. And the key thing is to try to get a sense of who are the silent supporters and where are they? And finally, will they be able to vote? I mean, COVID is starting to roll again, right? We're coming into the autumn. People are going to start getting flu, just like regular normal flu. But anybody who gets the flu, you know that they're going to be suspected of having COVID. And so the question is voter turnout. How much voter turnout is going to occur? How much is not going to occur because of COVID? How much is not going to occur as well because of the supposed voter suppression tactics? How much voter encouragement is going to work or not work compared to usual? All of these are wide open questions. I don't think we can assume anything.
Let's try to translate the various possible outcomes to what they mean for markets, because it's interesting to me that these things have changed so much. For a while, there was a very, very strong opinion expressed by financial professionals that, look, if Biden wins, it's got to be very negative for markets because it's going to mean more taxes and more burden on the economy. Now, what I'm seeing is a lot of financial pundits are saying that a Biden win is positive for markets. What are the actual drivers here? What does a Trump win mean? What does a Biden win mean? And what does just getting this over with mean for markets?
You know, I have to tell you, I've got a funny view on this. My view is that it doesn't matter. Whoever wins, we already know that half the country isn't going to like the outcome. And it's the same on both sides. So what we will have is certainty. And I think markets like certainty. So I personally think that markets might rise either way. The real danger is that if we don't get certainty, if we end up where the voting system is challenged, if we end up with a situation where the president refuses to leave, which a lot of people have talked about as a scenario, if we end up, imagine if Biden ends up winning, but he's down with COVID, right? Like, so is he going to make it? Is he going to be the next president, or is he on a ventilator? You know, all of these are possibilities that, you know, we have to think about. And I think it's the uncertainty that will cause markets to really come unstuck. Anything that's certainty, markets will be like, okay, phew, at least we know that. And again, because everyone's built in the worst possible outcomes, they're so sure that, you know, it's the Great Depression all over again. Any good news is going to go a long way. So I'm still leaning on the optimistic side here that either way, the markets settle down and half the country doesn't like the new leader and half the country does. And we've been in this position for quite some time. In a sense, not a lot changes.
Let me understand this a little better, Pippa. I agree with you, first of all, that uncertainty is what markets don't like. It seems to me that a high degree of uncertainty is a certainty, if that's not a contradiction of terms, in the sense that you know the election will be contested. That's for sure. Are you saying that's already priced in? Because I think it's likely that we don't know right up until Inauguration Day. There's a big Supreme Court battle, and you know, neither side is willing to concede, probably with a healthy dose of civil uprising from both sides, you know, violence in the streets over both sides feeling like their guy won and the other side is trying to undermine democracy by taking the election away from the fair and square winner. If that happens the way I just described it, are you saying, well, that's already kind of priced in, or are you saying that that would be a negative surprise for markets?
No, I'm saying that would be a negative surprise for markets. What I'm saying is, as long as we know who wins and it's not contested, either way, we know the outcome. Half the country likes the person, half the country doesn't. And then we just carry on as we have been for some years. If there's uncertainty about who is the new person or when are they coming to power, that is a definite, you know, that knocks markets sideways. That's going to be a big challenge. And the question is, I think you sound very confident that we're going to get a contested outcome. I think markets have not priced in that it's inevitable, but the probability is much higher than I've ever seen in my lifetime. So I think it is possible that we'll get a contested outcome or an uncertain result. Because I would add into those scenarios, not just the obvious ones that, you know, it's a challenge of, it's like the hanging Chad period where the votes themselves get challenged. I'm saying it could be that COVID comes into play and affects the people involved in politics. And that could be a whole new degree of uncertainty.
It's interesting to me. It sounds like you're not as convinced as I am. The reasons that I feel so convinced that this is that this uncertainty is a certainty, or that it's certain to be uncertain, is both sides have said very clearly they're not going to concede. And when challenged in the debate to say, "Will you at least tell your supporters not to resort to violence?" as you're not conceding. Neither one of them was willing to make a declarative and clear statement to that effect. So it seems to me like it's pretty darn certain that nobody's going to concede. Both sides are going to say that they won, and their supporters are likely to take to the streets. Am I missing something? Why do you disagree with that, if you disagree?
So do you remember a couple of months ago when George Floyd incident happened, when he died, and there was a guy who's called Magic Mike who came on to Twitter and he gave an amazing speech, an African-American, a very articulate fellow who's a very well known in the world of Instagram and Facebook and has come from an athletic background. Anyway, he gave this remarkable speech where he basically said, I know you're mad, but don't burn down your own neighborhood. And it was so moving. He also had he made reference to the fact that his relatives were all on the police department. And it was utterly wrong that this had happened to this poor man. But at the same time, so he totally supports the police and he did not support this murder. And so was he able to calm the community and allow them to be angry, but prevent them from being destructive? Yes, he was. And he wasn't like a community leader. He wasn't a political leader. He was just a person who, it's a good example of exercising personal leadership. And he just stepped up to the microphone and said very honestly how he felt. And, you know, he was crying. His emotions were high. You could see how much he was moved by this very, very awful situation. But he kept repeating that the solution is not violence. So I think there are a lot of people who have that view. And when the pressure really comes, they will just appear out of nowhere and they'll step up to the microphone and they'll say what the president and the presidential candidate probably should have said. But it's not that it won't be said. It will be said by someone. I'm very confident of that. You know, in America and our history, civil unrest and real destructive violence, it happens, but it usually doesn't last that long because people kind of come to their senses and realize that that's not the way you solve stuff. How you solve stuff is getting involved in the making of the rules and the policy and all that. And now there are lots of, you know, switched on Americans that will get that. So I don't know, maybe that's just me being an optimist about human nature.
Well, I definitely hope that you're right. I can't help but sort of feel like, first of all, I agree that was a very, very moving speech that gentleman made. A whole bunch of folks did burn their neighborhoods down after that. And I hope you're right, and I hope it doesn't happen anymore. I want to move on, though, to a prediction, or not really a prediction, but an insight that you shared with Macro Voices listeners several years ago. I think it was before President Trump even won the 2016 election. And your comment was that you thought that a significant part of the reason that President Trump chose to run for the presidency and the reason that he emphasized so heavily in his first campaign his frustrations and annoyances with the press was that you thought really his ultimate objective was to create the Trump News Network. And you thought that there was a possibility he might not even run for a second term, or that if he did run and lost his second term election, his next move would be to create his own news network. Now, Pippa, in your wildest dreams, could you ever have imagined a better setup to launch the Trump News Network than for President Trump to win re-election in the eyes of his supporters, but then have that election taken away from him by the Federal Election Commission, concluding that he didn't actually win, even though half the country thought that he won, because perhaps, as Jim Bianco explained to us, this notion of a red mirage, where it looks like the president won until they count all of the mail-in ballots and so forth, and then he didn't win. If that were to happen, in your wildest imagination, be a better setup for the Trump News Network to be launched? And do you still see that as a distinct possibility if he is not confirmed as being reelected?
Yeah, I think that this is coming. either way. If he is reelected, he's still going to be building that and preparing it for when he does leave office. And if he's leaving office at this juncture, then that's the platform I would expect him to go to. And I think that after he leaves the White House, he's going to have as big a voice in media and maybe bigger than he's had in the White House. And that was always the objective. I mean, it might be you could say that his objective was always to have the maximum impact voice no matter what. And you would just pick the best platform for that. And it happened to be the White House most recently. But I would say, no, it's actually even bigger than that. It's been a deliberate strategy, a belief that what Ted Turner did with CNN was the smart thing, because not only do you then get a way to broadcast yourself and your views, but you get paid a ton of money for it at the same time. Like, for someone like that, what's not to love? And, you know, globally, there's all kinds of signs that conservative news is starting to, you know, get backing and funding. We're seeing a new television stations being created here in the UK, for example, the new GB channel for Great Britain. There are several others. And so there's financing, there's money, there's a recognition that there's a conservative community that the traditional media wasn't really serving. And that there's a need for the stories to be told in this, you know, more conservative way. And so, you know, I think the real question is, do I think that if he launches this, it'll make money? Will it be a success? Will people watch it? My answer is it will. People will watch it. And it's not that I approve of the way the president, you know, uses media to make splashy headlines that, you know, are not substantively serious. It's just, you know, if you're going to be in that game, winning is about money and it's about eyeballs. It's about influence. And he has always been remarkably good at that. And I wouldn't underestimate his ability to do that very, very well. And again, why was he even running for the presidency initially? It was to get the ratings on this television program up back in 2016. And I still don't think that he or any of his team really thought he was going to win. And then he did. They're like, wow, okay, well, let's use this platform then. And when this platform goes, they'll say, let's have another platform. So I still bet money on that. And I do think it's going to change American politics, because whatever TNN is, I expect it's going to be more shocking, racier than anything we've seen on television so far. It may be a kind of cross between Fox News on steroids with a bit of porn thrown in. You know what I mean? Like he will not have any hesitation to put things up which are going to shock and surprise. He will go to the limits of what the law allows, and who knows, maybe a bit further.
Let's imagine 1 year from today that Joe Biden is in the Oval Office and Donald Trump is at the helm of TNN and on a regular show where he expresses his views in his own unique way. From your perspective as a geopolitical consultant and former presidential advisor, who's the more powerful influencer in that scenario? Who's got more power?
I hate to say it, but I think it's not Trump personally, but anyone with that kind of platform, that may be more powerful than the White House. I do think that the power of the West Wing was never what people assume it is. You know, and you know, my dad worked for four presidents, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and the limitations of power in the West Wing have always been more severe than people realize. It's not like you can just say anything you want or accomplish any task. It's very difficult to navigate the system of law and rules and tradition and public opinion, how to balance public opinion. It's quite a difficult task to manage from the Oval Office. To manage from a media platform, all you have to do is say and show whatever is going to get the biggest shock factor. You know, it's an easier task to just shock people. And they'll pay you for it. And they'll pay you with the time looking at it with their eyes, which leads to advertising dollars. So I think that's an easier task. And Trump is better equipped to make it work with that kind of a platform, even than the White House platform.
Pippa, I want to shift gears now. Your book, Geopolitics for Investors, written in 2015, was, I think, your first book that I'm aware of. 2016, you wrote Signals, which was just incredibly incisive, gave investors a perspective on how to interpret various different signals that go on geopolitically, what they mean for investors and markets. 2019, you got the Best Business Book of the Year Award and also an International Press Award for your 2019 book, Leadership Lab. You've got a sequel to the Leadership Lab that just came out called The Infinite Leader. Give us a refresher on what the Leadership Lab was about and what the sequel is about and how people can get a hold of it.
Well, so I co-authored both of them with Chris Lewis, who runs Lewis Media, which is the second largest privately owned PR firm in the world. And Chris is a Brit living in America, and I'm an American living in Britain. So we just started to collaborate on our views because we're advising a lot of people in the world of politics. And we saw that there's been a terrible breakdown of leadership. We've seen so many leaders get things wrong. And the number one reason why CEOs have left their position in the last couple of years has been ethical lapses. You're like, what's causing that? Why is this happening? So in the Leadership Lab, we started to review how to run organizations and why it is that the leader needs to have a better understanding of what is actually happening in the world and not coast on what they think, because what they think is happening might be like 10 years out of date. The infinite leader is more about the individual and the idea that the dialogue the individual has with themselves is what defines their capacity to lead. And that's why leadership is personal. And it's something that I exercise and you exercise and every one of us exercises every single day. It's not only about who is the president. It's about all the choices and decisions you make in the course of your day, like what you buy and how you spend your time and what you prioritize. And so the Infinite Leader is really written for individuals to start thinking about how they could manage their own lives better, especially in light of all these extraordinary, truly historic pressures being brought to bear on us all, like COVID, like a collapsing economy all around us, and how to reach a place where you can begin to be creative and innovative and build something new. Because that's how we're going to get out of all these troubles. It's going to be people building something new. And I'm very confident that this is definitely happening. The media won't write about it until the stories are so obvious. But I think that it's definitely happening. And it's actually a very exciting time in history. Painful, but I think it's going to result in quite a good outcome ultimately.
And the title is The Infinite Leader, available right now on Amazon. Pippa, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Kevin Muir and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO, Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts.
Eric, that's a terrific interview with Pippa. It's great to hear from a geopolitical analyst this close to the election.
Well, Kevin, I'm really looking forward to our post-game segment because I've been reading your Macro Tourist blog with great interest. I know you've been writing about the subjects that I think are most important. Regular Macro Voices listeners already know what's on my mind, but for anyone who's new, I'm convinced that if you can figure out where the U.S. dollar is headed from here, and you can figure out whether or not the bond bull market of 38 years has actually ended, or if U.S. Treasury rates can go negative at the 10-year maturity, and you can figure out whether or not we're about to make a secular shift toward inflation, you've totally nailed the macro picture, and you've got tremendous edge because, frankly, most of these idiots in finance have no clue what the answers to those questions are. Just one little issue. I'm one of those idiots, Kevin, who really has no clue what the answers to those questions are because it's a really complex macro landscape. You've been writing about all three of these things, and not only do you have a view on them, but it actually leads you to a trade that we're going to talk about. Let's start with the high-level big picture. Tell us about U.S. dollar, bond yields, and whether they can go negative on the U.S. 10-year, and inflation. Let's start with the high-level outlook on that, and then from there, go to how that gets you to a specific trade strategy.
Well, thanks, Eric. I think a lot of people that look at whether it be the U.S. dollar or inflation and come to the conclusion that the U.S. dollar is going to rally or that we're not going to get any inflation and we're going to get an implosion of prices, they're all using an old construct. They're all stuck on this idea that debt of a currency issuer is the same as debt of a currency user. And if there's one thing that's happened during COVID, it's been the fact that we've had this kind of watershed moment where the marketplace has woken up to the idea that governments are actually much different and they are not financially constrained and they can actually create as many dollars as they want. And once you kind of accept that and put aside for a second whether this is morally correct or whether this will end badly, it doesn't matter. You have to ask yourself, what's going to happen? I always say you should trade the market that is, not the one that you want to be. So if we stop and think about this and realize that the governments can create the dollars whenever they want, it kind of makes all of a sudden all these questions that you're asking about where this is going to go much easier. So let's just take the U.S. dollar. I look at the U.S. dollar and say, whose interest is it for it to go up? I think there's almost nobody. The global economy will do better with a lower U.S. dollar. We all need the liquidity. And so I'm confused as to why everyone thinks the U.S. dollar will go higher. I look at it and say the Fed and the government is going to create all the dollars that they need to send it lower. And in terms of inflation, I look at it and say, you know, again, does deflation benefit anyone? No. So therefore, I look at the government and the central banks and say they're going to create enough dollars to make inflation. And I think that everyone that's continuing to use those old playbooks are kind of assuming that the only way to create dollars is through the private sector. And there's no doubt that over the past 30 years, we have relied on private sector credit creation as the main way to create dollars. Every time there's been a recession, what's happened is the Fed's come and cut rates, and we've basically tried to encourage more bank loans to rejuvenate the economy. Until finally, when we hit the great financial crisis, we hit the zero bound. And at that point, basically, private sector credit creation was no longer. And of course, we tried some extreme measures. We tried quantitative easing. We tried a million different other things. Even look at what they do in Europe. They went to negative rates. All these insane policies. Well, I think that what 2020 has shown, and with the advent of the COVID, is that they realize that governments can spend money into existence and create the inflation and the demand that they need. Now, again, you might think this will all end bad. Who cares? the reality is that if you were one of those people that were in the camp that the Fed wasn't going to be able to create the liquidity in March or in April and May, what's happened is everything's rallied in your face. So I've always said that we can always create inflation whenever we want. It's only a matter of political will. And I think what's happened is with the COVID crisis, we've finally gotten that political will that we've needed. So for me, I look at it and go, I think the dollar's headed lower, and I think that the inflation's headed higher.
Kevin, I have to agree with you. I don't like it, but you know what's on top of my reading list right now is Stephanie Kelton's The Deficit Myth. And I don't think it's really a myth, but I do know that Stephanie Kelton has a heck of a lot more influence on public policy and monetary policy than I do or anyone that I know. And it's important to understand, as you say, what's coming, not what I wish was coming, but what is coming. But Kevin, here's the thing I find interesting. You'd expect with that setup that you were going to dive into a gold trade because that's the way a lot of people think about responding to this idea that governments around the world, including the United States, are going to print more money. But you prepared a really great chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads right above Dr. Pippa Malmgren's picture. Kevin, the title is not Buy Gold, Be a Gold Bug. It's Yield Curve Steepening. So why is it that you see a yield curve steepener as the trade to play this?
Well, Eric, I don't want to lose my status as a gold bug as well. You can also, I think gold will be a beneficiary of what we just discussed. But I think that a lot of people are missing the opportunities that are presented in the bond market. And I still contend that before this is all through, that the yield curve is going to go to record wides. Now, in the meantime, what's happened is that the bond market is, I joked the other day that if you went and looked, if it was the bond market chart was someone's pulse, you would have pulled that person into the morgue long ago because it had gotten so sleepy. And I look at this and I think that there's a great opportunity. But before we get to that, I actually want to talk about quantitative easing. And I wanted to talk about why this time is different than the previous times. And you touched upon the deficit myth and Stephanie Kelton and the MMT folk. And so one of the things that happened in the advent of the great financial crisis, if you remember when we did the first quantitative easings, everyone was worried about all this hyperinflation that was going to be created. And then in the second one, the second quantitative easing, we actually got to a point where some very bigwig kind of economists and market strategists took out a full page ad, an open letter to Ben Bernanke telling him how it was going to end badly. Well, you know, even the third, people were still convinced that there was going to create inflation. And none of those created inflation. And then what was interesting about this, Eric, was that although they were worried it was going to create inflation, and it actually caused the bond market to rise in yield as the Federal Reserve was doing its quantitative easing, every time the Fed stopped doing QE, bond yields fell. And I have this great chart that goes through them all, and it shows the first quantitative easing where yields rose from 2 to 3.95. And then the moment the quantitative easing fell or stopped, yields fell. Quantitative easing 2, the QE2 program, yields rallied from 2.5 to 3.75. Then again, the moment it stopped, yields fell. Finally, quantitative easing 3, which was QE infinity because there's no end to it. It rose from 160 to 3, and then they tapered it. And as they tapered it, the yields went down. And what that was a function of the market coming to terms with the idea that quantitative easing can't actually create inflation. And I know that that seems kind of counterintuitive to what a lot of people believe, because you see all this money going into the economy and you think to yourself, oh, geez, that money's going to create inflation. But I'd like to go through kind of the plumbing of it to really understand this. Let's just kind of think about when JP Morgan sells a bond to the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve comes and they buy a bond from JP Morgan. So let's say they buy, you know, $500 million, $500 million. So now all of a sudden, the Federal Reserve has $500 million more on its balance sheet, and JP Morgan has $500 million more cash. But if you think about JP Morgan, are they any more inclined to make a loan because all of a sudden they sold some bonds to the Fed? Like, was that really what was stopping them from making the loans in the first place? Or does JP Morgan make loans based upon proper borrowers and then their own balance sheet, you know, whether, you know, the equity and the capitalization of it? The reality is that quantitative easing would have never, ever created inflation. It's you hear people talk about it being an asset swap. And this is why, because it just, it ends up being that JP Morgan takes that money that's sitting on, you know, their balance sheet, and they just deposit it back into the Fed, and it goes up. And that's why interest on excess reserves keeps going through the moon. Now, I think it's interesting, though, that in the first three times we had quantitative easing, yields rose as the Federal Reserve was buying bonds. And that was because the market was convinced it was going to create inflation. And it wasn't just me that thought this. I actually have a great quote from Stanley Druckenmiller, who I view as one of the best traders of all time. And he says, and my theory was, QE, the buying of bonds by the government, would cause risk to go and therefore decrease the demand for bonds from other entities. It took about 5 weeks, but it worked. Then we stopped QE, and sure enough, the day we stopped QE, bonds went up, stocks went down. Everyone blamed it on Boehner and Obama having a hissy fit with each other in the White House, but I have followed this for 8 years, and it was 7-for-7. When the government buys bonds, bonds go down, and stocks go up, and vice versa. Now, I have a little bit of a quibble with Stanley Druckenmiller. I think that the reason bonds went up in yield was because there was a yield curve shift within the kind of bond community. Meaning if you're a bond manager and you're seeing quantitative easing and you're seeing future inflation, you will go and you will sell your long bonds and buy short bonds in the hopes of reinvesting them later at a higher inflation rate. Now, on the first two quantitative easings, they went straight up. Yields went straight up the moment they announced it. The third one took a little longer. Now, let's fast forward to today. The corona crisis comes, and this time, yields don't go anywhere. We don't get any sort of reaction at all. And now, risk still went bid. So according to Stanley Druckenmiller, people should be moving from bonds into risk, and that should be causing yields to go up, but they're not. Now, obviously, the government is buying some, and that's keeping a bid to it. But I would argue that more importantly is that people haven't, they've come to the conclusion the quantitative easing doesn't cause inflation. And so therefore, they're not worried about it. Now, I think that the 2020, the COVID crisis, has changed the landscape. Whereas before, in the great financial crisis, we tried to fix everything with more and more monetary stimulus, and the government was actually doing pro-cyclical fiscal cuts. This time, we've had massive fiscal stimulus at the same time. And the punchline of all this is that if you go and do quantitative easing along with fiscal stimulus, that is going to create the inflation that was missing the previous times. So ironically enough, the previous quantitative easings caused the bond market to sell off for yields to go up. And this time it didn't. But this time, it's actually more likely that we're going to get inflation than any of the previous times, because this time it's been married with spending.
Kevin, when you talk about a yield curve steepener, are we talking 2s, 10s, 5s, 30s? What steepener are we talking about?
So I love the 5-30, Eric. That's kind of the meaty part of it for me. I look at it and I think the Fed's on hold for a long time. I have this interesting chart where if I go back and look over the past kind of 50 years, 40 years, and look at, and whenever you had a recession, what happened coming out of the recession? Well, in the early 90s recession, yields actually fell. Again, in the 2000 dot-com bubble, coming out of the recession, yields fell. In the 2008, yields went sideways. But then if we go and look at that same chart and we look at the 530 spread coming out of those recessions, we'll see that each time the yield curve got significantly steeper. So I look at this and I think to myself, this is the place that I want to play. I want to be long the 5-year, 30-year yield spread.
Now, let me understand why a spread is opposed to an outright trade on one of the legs. Because normally, the reason that you favor a steepener trade is because you're leaving room for either a bull or a bear steepener. In other words, it could be that the longer duration yield goes up, or you could make money if the shorter duration yield goes down. But here's the thing, Kev. If we look at the 5-year U.S. Treasury right now, it's only yielding 33 basis points. How much down can it go from there?
Well, Eric, you should never say never, right? And the thing is, who knows? We could get a situation where they go negative. They're negative 50 basis points in Europe. And one of the things is that I just look at this and say, yes, maybe being outright short bonds is a good trade. And I just think that this is a much better risk reward scenario. If I'm wrong, then I suspect the 5-year will be going down to stupid kind of low level yields and it won't hurt as much. And then if I'm right, I think that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to leave the short end pinned. And I don't think that the 5-year is going to rise in yield that much.
So it sounds like really the way you're thinking about this is it's not so much the usual steepener trade where you're not sure if it's a bull or a bear steepener. It's more of you're bearish on long-term treasuries, but you're not so confident that you don't want some kind of hedge, and your hedge is to be long, short-dated treasuries.
Bingo. Completely agree, Eric. I think it's a great trade. I think it's probably one of the best out there. I know that the 5-year seems to have no upside, but as I said, if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that anything can happen. And I feel a lot more confident being long 5 years against my short 30 years.
Kevin, before we wrap up this week's show, our listeners already know about Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading, but not all of them are familiar with the Macro Tourist. Tell us about it briefly.
Well, thanks, Eric. I write a letter. I call it my almost daily letter. Talk about a variety of different topics. I try to make it fun, interesting. I know this isn't politically correct, but I call myself the Playboy of financial newsletter writers because everyone says that they're subscribing to read the articles, but we all know they're just looking at the pictures. And for those who are interested, check it out. It's the macrotourist.substack.com. And if you want to see a couple old versions or copies of it, feel free to shoot me an email, kevin@themacrotourist.com.
I can't recommend it highly enough. And although there's lots of really great macro letters out there, nobody has better pictures than you do. I definitely will agree with that point. We're going to leave it there for this week's show, folks. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors, and by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And folks, be sure to check your research roundup email. Patrick is not with us to do his expert rundown on what you can expect there, but as usual, you'll find a link to the transcript from today's interview with Pippa Malmgren, as well as all of the best research that our volunteer research team could find for free on the internet.
So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag us with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna and myself, thank you for listening and have a great week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.